From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, Hollywood studios are slashing producer deals in record numbers. What are these producer pacts, and what does it mean for the kinds of movies that we'll be seeing? Plus, when it comes to production companies, what's in a name? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from NPR. Things got a little hairy last week for Barnes & Noble and for Hollywood. For starters, the bookseller posted a drop in quarterly profit last week and cut its full year's sales forecast. Now, sure, the economy is in the deathly hallows, but it was the lack of a certain sorcerer that did the most damage. With no new Harry Potter book on the shelves this year, sales at Barnes & Noble stores open at least a year fell 4.7%. How important is Mr. Potter? Well, when you exclude last year's Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, same-store sales fell only 1.5%. In related Harry news, 2 weeks ago, Warner Brothers said it was moving Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, the sixth film in its wildly profitable Potter franchise, from November of this year to July of next. Warner's PR machine spun the move as something made possible because The Dark Knight had exceeded expectations, taking pressure off this year's box office. But what is likely the real reason was revealed last week. Warner's needs a guaranteed moneymaker next year, and they may not be able to release their 2009 blockbuster, Watchmen. Last week, a federal judge ruled that rival studio, 20th Century Fox, could challenge Warner Brothers' rights to Watchmen, an action movie that Warner's has already spent $100 million to make. The studio was planning on releasing the film, based on the comic book of the same name, next March. We'll keep a close watch on Watchmen and Warner's box office prospects in the weeks to come. Finally, an ugly U.S. economy is starting to affect the Great White Way. Variety noted last week that no fewer than 5 planned Broadway shows had been scrapped before they'd even gotten a chance to tread the boards. That's an enormous number, considering there are only 39 Broadway theaters in total. Among the casualties, the prophetically named Harry Connick Jr. musical, Nice Work If You Can Get It. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, getting rid of the shingles. You know, studio production companies, not the disgusting. There are 1,963 production companies listed in the Hollywood Creative Directory. Of that number, only 174, or 9%, have deals with a major film studio. In fact, according to Variety's annual look at these deals called Facts on Pacts, fewer producers can call a studio home than at any time in recent history, 50% fewer in the last 3 years alone. So what are these deals, and what does it say about the business that the studios are cutting back on them in such great number? Adam Fields has had pacts with most of the majors, most recently at New Line Cinema, which was absorbed into Warner Brothers in February. He's the producer of such movies as Donnie Darko, Brokedown Palace, Ravenous, and Great Balls of Fire. We spoke to him at his office, which, by the way, is not on a lot. Adam Fields, welcome to The Business.
Thanks for having me.
What is a production deal?
I guess in its simpler form, it's a contractual relationship between the studio and a producer, which on the lowest level is a housekeeping deal where in exchange for
some light dusting. And
yeah, for a first look and first crack at all your projects and ideas, they provide you with office, assistant, small expense account. And on the far right of that extreme is the large, huge production deal that, you know, very few have, a Brian Grazer or Scott Rudin or Jerry Bruckheimer, where they, in return for you being exclusive, pay you a large guarantee against your fees and provide an enormous amount of overhead and infrastructure and staff and a discretionary fund to buy projects. And in between, there's all different variations, or maybe they provide you development staff, provide you a small advance against your fees.
So how do you get one of these delicious deals?
Well, they're certainly harder and harder to come by, but usually you're proven to be good at what you do, which is finding material and developing projects, and you have a relationship with that studio, and they think that having you there on a slightly more consistent basis and getting first crack your material is of value to them and will be productive for everyone.
Well, I want to pick up on that because, you know, we asked you, so you actually mentioned what you get, which is, you know, a desk, a phone, a girl to answer it, a guy to answer it, not to be sexist, maybe some Snapple to feed to prospective writer types, and then, you know, maybe a small discretionary fund to go, you know, buy a book or, you know, get some rights for something. What do they get really out of that arrangement?
Well, they're getting first crack at your material. They're getting first crack at your ideas. You know, a lot of my movies come from my own original ideas and experiences. So they're getting first crack at that. And they're also getting someone who they believe can help them develop projects that they're looking to develop and attract talent that they want to be in business with, and someone that ultimately will help manage and produce the films that you've developed in a way that they feel comfortable with and they can rely on and they think is dependable.
Now, you had a deal recently. Of course, the studio imploded, so no deal anymore. But you had a deal at New Line Cinema.
I've had a deal at New Line. I think I've had a over the course of my career, I think I've had a I've been a producer on, I think, every lot in town except for Disney, which I'm still not quite sure where that is.
I think it's over north
somewhere. But yeah. I think I've had a producing arrangement with a relationship with, I think, every studio in town over, including New Line, over 25 years of doing this.
So how'd you get your deal? I mean, literally, walk me through it. What happens?
You know, my deal at Fox, I had sold them a couple of projects, and I just left being an executive at another studio, and they said, look, we'd like to bring you over here. You seem pretty good at finding these projects. We like your energy. You seem tenacious and resourceful for, you know, a very minimal investment on their part. You know, again, office assistant and phones and small expense account. You know, they got first crack and at whatever I was doing.
So what did they get, by the way?
And that one I developed from an idea of mine, Broke Down Palace, which is a movie we started shooting, I think, from an idea to production within less than a year. A quirky movie, Ravenous, from then first-time writer Ted Griffin, who, of course, went on to do the Ocean 11 movies, and a number of other projects that are still in development, and some that ended up not ever going to fruition.
Do you know a studio better when you're there on the lot? Does it make the process of making a movie easier for being there as opposed to not being there? Do you know the politics, the landmines?
I think it does, but everyone's relationship and experience is different. For me, I think it's really productive. I mean, when you're there, you're not an employee, but you're sort of on the team. And you have a much better sense of what each executive is looking for, what the studio's needs are. I think just the proximity of being on the lot, it just facilitates getting things done. You can run into an executive. You know, you can
run over.
You can walk over. You know where they're going to park, so you can just happen to run into them. You can wander by, you know, based on your relationship, business affairs office, and stick your head in and hope to maybe grab them between phone calls. You know, as your films go into production, you have a relationship with marketing, publicity, distribution. I just think, you know, proximity creates, you know, accessibility and just creates more opportunity. And I think for the agents and the creative talent.
Well, that's really going to be my next question. How does the outside world treat you differently when you're part of this enclave of.
You have an immediate affiliation and a validation. You know, as agents are trying to sell material, they're looking for anyone that can help them get that material sold and ultimately that movie made. And if they believe you're there at the studio and you have a relationship with the executives and they want to work with you and you're going to be there helping nudge the process along, that's good for them. So they'll be more inclined. They have a script and they want to take it to one studio. Who's going to be the conduit to help us get it sold? Producer on the lot, a producer with a deal there, and that's a relationship. It was friendly with the head of the studio and the president of the production. That's going to help them.
So those are the advantages. So
right.
Are there any disadvantages?
Are there any disadvantages? I don't know any disadvantage when someone wants to pay your overhead. I guess if you have your own funding and you really can afford to operate autonomously, it's nice to, I guess, probably have some room and flexibility to go from one studio to the other and not be caught up in first right of refusal, first right of negotiation. But, you know, I think if you're a young mid-level producer, I see no disadvantage. I think, you know, it's again, it's good to have your overhead covered. It's good to have access to the executives. It's good to sort of be, again, part of a team.
Right. So when regime change occurs at Fox or Universal or Paramount or any of these splendid kingdoms, what happens to the producers on the lot? Is there an instantaneous purge, or what becomes of these producers who no longer have the favor of the king?
Well, everything's about your relationship with the studio, and hopefully it's not just about your relationship with one person, but that's certainly a relevant issue. But you have a contract. And I'm probably, if your relationship was with that studio head and your contract's coming up, you probably have something to be concerned about. If you have years to go, you have an opportunity to build a new relationship with the new incoming president, or presumably the new president was the executive vice president who you were working with who just got promoted, or it's someone you work with at another studio. So, the merry-go-round continues. So certainly change is always disheartening. But I don't think it necessarily means it's fatal. You know, New Line Pictures, my relationship's with Toby Emmerich. So as that studio's changed, Toby's been promoted, and that's, you know, good for me.
Is there any movie you made that could never have been made had you not had a deal on the lot?
Yeah, probably all of them. In my case, the kind of movies that I make tend to come from young first-time directors like Donnie Darko and, you know, as an executive, 16 Candles and Breakfast Club, a young director, John Hughes. Ravenous was like a weird idea for a movie from a first-time writer. Broke Down Palace, a first-time writer. So they're not big, obvious video games or big best-selling books. They're ideas that came from my own passion, my own sort of like just desire to do something that, knowing the right executive and getting a sense of who would be interested in this, I think is the reason most of them got made. You know, when I did Great Balls of Fire, it's something I've been trying to do since I was 22, and it took me, I think, 10 years to get made, and, you know, I had a torturous history of rights and complications and lawsuits, but I was just finishing a film for Orion Pictures at the time. I knew Mike Medavoy was had a deal with Sean Penn and Dennis Quaid, and they were both right for the picture, and they both wanted to do it, and because we were talking every day about the other movie I was finishing, I was able to at the right time say, this is something we should do next. This is what I want to do next. And I don't think if I wasn't in sort of a daily dialogue or in at their offices on, every other day, I don't know that I would have just sort of sold that just on the idea.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to producer Adam Fields about what it means to be a producer on the lot. According to Variety, fewer producers can call a studio home than at any time in recent history. If these deals don't cost so much, if we're talking about a phone, a desk, a little bit of money, a few cases of Snapple, what do we read into the fact that so many producers are being asked to decamp from so many studios? What does it say about the movie business?
Well, I think it says a lot, and I think you can trace it all back to the late 80s and early 90s, and it's a slow progression. But, you know, starting, I think, in 1989, every single standalone studio was acquired by a larger corporate multinational conglomerate, you know, GE being the second largest multinational company in the world, owning Universal, Sony owning Columbia, Viacom owning Paramount, News Corp owning Fox. And the movie studios have become divisions within a larger conglomerate. And their mandate has become reduce overhead and expenses and increase earnings. And as a result, over a slow progression, and this is somewhat of a generalization since there's a lot of great executives I like working with, the creative executive, by the demands of his job, has turned into more of a product manager. And as a result, they're sort of less interested in someone's creative point of view. You know, producers in many respects are looked at as someone that's just between them and the director and the movie they're trying to get made. And they're less your creative partner.
Suggesting they used to be.
Yeah, I think they very much used to be. You felt like, you know, when you were making movies, the creative executive was your partner, and his priority was to help you make the best movie possible And if the movie turned out great, he would be rewarded by the bosses. And they would run interference for you, and they would help protect the movie from, quote-unquote, their bosses or the suits. You know, now I find times when I want to share something with the creative executive, they'll go, don't tell me that. If you tell me that, I have to tell my boss, because if he finds out I knew, I could get fired. So, you know, you could have a day where maybe it didn't go so well that day on the set, and you want to reshoot it, and we can figure out how to fit it into the schedule so it doesn't cost anything more, but we kind of want to hide that day. You know, can you take the executive into your confidence? Or he's going to go, don't tell me that. I don't want to know that. Well, I think in a prior day, they would have been great. But yeah, this is what we need to do to navigate the system.
They would have applied a little body English to the pinball
machine.
They
would have helped
and...
you get that done. You know, there used to be sort of a funny joke. You would say that, you know, guess what that a creative executive said when I asked him what he thought of the script? He go, I don't know. I haven't talked to my boss yet. And you go, ha, ha, ha. That's very funny. Now it would be very commonplace. Go, I don't know. We haven't had the staff meeting yet. I don't know what we think.
How is this move towards, you know, quarter by quarter emphasis on we got to make our numbers, we got to hit growth, we got to – how is that changing the kinds of movies we're going to see in theaters?
Well, I think it's changing in many respects, and part of it's not just that you have to meet your earnings. You know, we've become a much more global world. The dissemination of information is so instantaneous that you need now primarily to open movies sort of day and day around the world. While, in, you know, 10 years ago you could open the movie in the United States and then you'd open it maybe 5 months later in a certain territory, and 4 months later you'd open it in France when they come back from their summer. You know, you can't do that anymore. You need to be able to open the movie day and day around the world.
It also means, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but it would seem to mean that the kind of movie that needs to take time to find an audience and develop positive word of mouth, it is completely not something that the big studios are interested in anymore.
No, and I mean, there was a point when they were all opening their own sort of independent classic division, and that's all started to contract. But, you know, part of that is also you got to give some allowance for what the internet has done in terms of piracy. If you don't open your movie around the world simultaneously, it's going to get pirated and be sent there anyway. So, you know, again, the kind of movie that you can open in Japan, France, United States, and South America in the same day is big global entertainment.
Big action movie.
Action adventures, sci-fi, but big, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean, a big, you know, Harry Potter.
Not Donnie Darko.
Not Donnie Darko. Not Brokeback Palace. Not Breakfast Club or not 16 Candles either. I don't know that those movies would have gotten made in this day and age.
So is there any producer who is bulletproof, who cannot be shot out of a cannon?
Well, I think those that are productive and those who have a relationship with the studio that create, you know, good supply of product, I think they want to keep. And I don't think anyone anymore is beyond sort of scrutiny and reevaluation. You know, certain people have a relationship with talent, but if those talent aren't consistent anymore, they're certainly going to be, you know, they're going to look at those deals very hard.
So give me the star qualities of a superstar producer.
Jerry Bruckheimer consistently makes great movies. They look great. They do well. He's a supplier of films on a regular basis. The studio can look to him and know that he's going to deliver. When you're making movies now where they've set a release date 3 years from now or 2 years from now before you've even seen a second draft of the screenplay, they know they can rely on him that he's going to deliver and meet that date as well as anyone is capable of doing it. Or that Scott Rudin is going to find just the best material and put the best talent together and deliver a really quality picture. And, you know, that's something you can rely on.
Coming up after a short break, more with producer Adam Fields. We're talking about what cuts in studio producing pacts will mean for what we see on the big screen. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We're talking to producer Adam Fields about producer studio deals. According to Variety, fewer producers can call the studio home than at any time in recent history. 50% fewer in the last 3 years alone. Even huge names like Marshall Herskovitz, the producer of Blood Diamond and The Last Samurai, and president of the Producers Guild, no less, recently did not see his deal renewed at Warner Brothers. We're talking with Adam Fields, who's had packs at every major studio except Disney. Even as we look at Variety's list of producers, which shrinks year by year by year, as I sit and watch the credits of these movies, the number of producers listed is astonishing to mind-numbing. I mean, I saw a picture recently with 18 executive producers. Who the hell are these people?
That's a good question. I think it's indicative of the sort of circuitous route it takes to get a movie made, that someone might have developed it, someone else might have put up some initial seed money, someone else has come in who is the partner of the director and he's a producer, someone else has brought equity financing to the picture. Someone was the studio head at the time the picture was initiated, and now they're not, and they've asked to be added to that picture as part of their exit package. It's so difficult to get movies made, and the path is so circuitous and torturous that everywhere sort of along that path, someone sort of joins the train.
Lest we think that producers are somehow held in lower esteem now than ever before, there's a great story that goes about the value of a producer at a big studio on a big movie and sort of your place in the Hollywood firmament. Tell that story.
I was in Thailand scouting locations for a picture, and anyone who's been to Thailand, I know you've been to Thailand, you know the traffic is horrendous, and we were looking for a specific type of location, a temple that would match the Grand Palace. And every place we'd go to, we'd spend an hour and a half in traffic going one way and an hour and a half coming back, and you know we were getting to see two locations in a day, and I could see my director was starting to have a little bit of a meltdown. So I said, well, this is silly. Why don't I just get a helicopter, and the director and the production designer and I will fly over the city, and he can look at everything he wants to look at, and if it's something he likes, we'll then drive back and try and be a little more time efficient. So I put in a request for a helicopter, and I get a screaming phone call from business affairs. He goes, what are you, a dope? You can't put the director in a helicopter. We don't have a life insurance policy on him. Make sure you have a life insurance policy. So I said, okay. So I took out a life insurance policy for the production designer, myself, and the director. And I get a call back going, we're not paying for your policy or the production designers. And I said, well, why is that? He goes, well, if you die, we can still make the picture. I said, yeah, I kind of knew that. Just kind of stinks to hear it.
Adam Fields is a film producer based in Los Angeles. He's made movies like Money Train, Great Balls of Fire, Broke Down Palace, and one of my favorites, Donnie Darko. Adam, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you guys.
When it comes to production shingles, there are two kinds of names, those named for their founders and those that are not. Of the former, most are eponymous, like Jerry Bruckheimer Films. But some are more clever. Oprah's Harpo Productions, that's Oprah spelled backwards, but you knew that. Director Chris Columbus has a company. It's called 1492. Shingles that don't use their founders as their namesakes can be further broken down into two more categories. Those that make bold statements, like Legendary Pictures or Spike Lee's 40 Acres and a Mule, and those that are decidedly esoteric. For instance, director Darren Aronofsky's company, Phineas Gage, was named after a 17th century railroad worker who survived a traumatic brain injury. Ever curious, our producer Matt Holtzman asked, when it comes to a shingle, what's in a name?
What's in a name? It's just some letters that we string together. We're all the same.
When I started my production company, I think I went through 12 different proposed names and nothing cleared. And I got the advice from my lawyer that I needed to come up with something a lot more personal and arcane.
Sean Levy is the director of A Night at the Museum and The Pink Panther. His production company is called 21 Laps.
So right around that time, my firstborn daughter had her school jogathon. You know, the kids are 5 years old, and my daughter, who at that time was not particularly athletic, I'm thinking she'll do 5, 6, 7 laps and then sit down exhausted. So there I was on the side of the track, and I literally witnessed my kid go into this place of pure will and focus, and without breaking stride once, she busted out 21 laps in a row, and it was one of the proudest moments in my life as a parent. And now, sadly, I've had two other daughters, so I need to start ancillary companies.
Grant Heslov is the Academy Award-nominated writer and producer of Good Night and Good Luck and the producing partner of George Clooney at Smokehouse Productions.
Our office is directly across the street from a restaurant called The Smokehouse. It's been there for forever and has a great bar and red booths. And George has been on this lot for even longer than I have. And, you know, it's just a place where you can go over and have a drink. And we were racking our brains trying to come up with a name for our company. And then he drove away, and I got a call on the phone 5 minutes later, and he's like, Smokehouse. I said, perfect.
Greg Daniels is the writer and producer of The Office. His company is Deedle D.
My wife and I were beginning in the entertainment industry, and when we were dating, we talked about forming a big entertainment company together, and her maiden name was Lieberstein. So we talked about it being Daniels, Lieberstein Daniels, which would be DLD. And somehow or another, we started calling it Deedle D. My daughter, Haley, drew the logo that is the one that appears after The Office.
Akiva Goldsman won the Adapted Screenplay Oscar for A Beautiful Mind and has produced a long string of films, including Hancock and I Am Legend.
Weed Road is the name of the road where the treatment center that my parents founded was located. I grew up basically in and amongst a group home population, and it was the central component to my early life. It was called Blueberry Treatment Centers, and that's why there's a blueberry in the center of the Weed Road logo.
But I just wonder, are you trying to say that your workplace is a group home, a place of healing and hope, or that everyone there is a little emotionally unstable?
Both.
What's in a name?
James L. Brooks has had a storied career in show business, producing films like Jerry Maguire and TV shows like The Simpsons. His company is called Gracie Films.
Gracie Allen seems to represent some sweet spirit of comedy to me.
Did her husband ever comment about it?
Yes, yes. George Burns, as fate would have it, came into my office one day, and there's a great, I have a great picture of him in my office someplace, and, you know, I don't think he was too interested in my story, but it didn't stop me from being thrilled I was able to tell it to him. He was so great, but George Films doesn't work.
A last note, we talked to a number of producers who had great stories behind their shingle names. Alas, due to tightened FCC regulations, we could not air those stories here. For The Business, I'm Matt Holzman.
It's just a name.
Another notable production company name is Clint Eastwood's Malpaso, which is Spanish for bad step or misstep. Legend has it that when Eastwood agreed to take the role of the stranger in High Plains Drifter, his agent told him that it would be a bad step. Imagine the career that Clint could have had if only he'd taken his agent's advice. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. Thanks to Whitney Alderson for her help in producing our shingle name piece. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can podcast the show, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button using our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can still podcast the show through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Club Professor Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
The one that I liked best, probably other than Deedle D, was Secret Air Force Nerve Gas Project, because I wanted to see a lot of my contracts and checks and just the paper trail of all these big companies writing checks to Secret Air Force Nerve Gas Project. Seemed like it'd be humorous to me. If I had to choose another one now, I probably should have gone back and called it something like Greg Daniels Productions, because that would have probably been the best marketing for my career.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.